From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler.
Columbus-based wellness author Nita Sweeney was a Faulkner Society Award finalist and an Ohio Arts Council Governor's Award nominee for her 2019 memoir, Depression Hates a Moving Target. The book was a number one Amazon new release in the mood disorders, bipolar disorder, and running and jogging categories. She has released three other books since then, the 2020 co-authored writing journal called You Should Be Writing, a journal of inspiration and instruction to keep your pen moving, 2022's Make Every Move a Meditation, Mindful Movement for Mental Health, Well-Being, and Insight, and her latest, A Daily Dose of Now, 365 Mindful Meditation Practices for Living in the Moment. Welcome to Craft, Nita Sweeney.
Thank you.
And we should also mention that you will be a guest at the 2024 Ohioana Book Festival, which is coming up soon, and more information about that will be on the website. So congratulations.
Thank you. I love the Ohioana Book Festival. I'm very excited about it.
You describe your writing journey on your website at nitasweeney.com, but can you lead our listeners through a brief discussion of how you came to write your memoir, Depression Hates a Moving Target?
Well, I've been writing for years in different capacities. I was an attorney for about a decade, and in that I did legal writing and research, and I have written journalistic articles. But my dream was always to have a book-length project, you know, that book on the shelf with my name on it. Call it egotistical, but I was an avid reader, many writers are, and I wanted to be one with my name on the book. So that's kind of how it started. But I had a pretty serious mental health issue. I continue to have that. And so when my legal career came to an end, I doubled down on the writing. And I've actually written 12 or 13 book-length projects in various drafts. But the book that finally sold was Depression Hates a Moving Target. And so you've seen those memes with the iceberg where there's the tip that you see above the water.
Right.
Well, those other books are all under the water and lots of flailing around and studying with different teachers, getting an MFA, pitching to agents and editors and all of that stuff that you just don't see. I actually wrote a blog post about it taking me 20 years to be an overnight success. And I don't think that's actually uncommon with writers, but what you see is this blast in 2018. Oh my gosh, I got a contract. And then in 2019, the book comes out and there's so much more that went behind it. But that first book, I really think it was the right time for that book in my life. It was the right time because it was a mental health book for that book in the world and for that publisher, Mango Publishing Group. They were smaller than they are now, and they take a lot of small bets. I think they still do. And I was a pretty small bet. I was not exactly a known commodity. I mean, people knew me here in Central Ohio, but I was definitely a small pond, if you will. So that mental health book for that publisher and that time in my life, for me to be able to write about that journey, it landed. And I am forever grateful.
So tell me about how it landed for you. You said you had submitted the draft for Depression Hates a Moving Target multiple times, and then you submitted it to Mango. How long did it take them to write back? When did that become clear that they were going to publish it for you?
So I had pitched 108 agents, 132 publishers, and entered a ton of contests. At one point, I think it may have been 30. And I had heard from Brenda Knight, who at that time she was the acquisitions editor, in March of 2018. We had had a phone conversation and she'd asked me to send her a draft. And then I didn't hear anything. I just didn't know what happened. That happens a lot. And so I figured, okay, I'm done with them. That was exciting. And so I was at a place where the story about running for mental health, that's what the story is about. It was important enough to me that if I couldn't get a traditional publisher, I was going to self-publish it. It just felt so important to me. And I was at the place where I'd started investigating all of that. And I'd said to my husband, it looks like I'm not going to get the gold star, which is what traditional publishing felt kind of like to me, you know, when you're vetted by somebody else and you're not paying them, they're paying you, things like that. And so he said, well, what about that lady you talked to in March? And so I figured it wouldn't hurt to nudge her. So I sent her an email. she had never received from me the materials she had requested. I'd sent them, but you know how the interwebs go. She'd never gotten them. And so we started up another conversation. That was early August. And by the 23rd of August, I had an offer. So it happened pretty quickly once it got rolling. And the biggest thing they wanted that I didn't have was more of a social media following. Again, I'd published a monthly newsletter for Central Ohio Writers, right now Columbus, for many, many years. And so I had a lot of followers there, subscribers, and I had some Facebook followers, but it was a personal account. I didn't have a page. I didn't have a big following on any of the other channels. And she gave me a couple of weeks to try to increase those numbers. And I was able to do that. And I know now that part of that is because when you're working with a publisher or an agent for that matter, part of what they're trying to figure out is, are you the kind of person who is going to respond to their request? Are you going to be somebody who's easy to work with? Are you a team player? Things like that. So the numbers were important, but also the way I responded to that request was important. And she gave me some tips as to what to do. And I followed her direction and was able to increase, especially at that time, they were on Twitter, now called X, but that was sort of their big place that Mango was promoting and wanted to see those numbers. And so we just doubled down, and that's what I asked all my friends, go on Twitter and follow everything. And, you know, I just kept posting and posting, and that's how it worked. And she just saw that I was all in and increased those numbers. And we were able to put those better numbers into the proposal, because I think people don't realize that I had this lovely woman who was interested in my work, loved the book, wanted it to be published by her company, but she's not the last word. She has right. to sell it to her sales team. And so she needed me to help her be able to sell it. And then I got an email, which I still have a screenshot of. It says, yes, we want to move forward and publish your book. And it sounds maybe overly dramatic, but it was a day, an email, a moment that changed my life, because I went from an aspiring author to someone who has been published. And it was the beginning of a wonderful relationship with Mango and with Brenda, which has continued. But it took probably a couple of years that I was sending out all these pitches and just, I'd get a nibble here too, but nobody really wanted it. And then Brenda was really excited from the beginning. And there's not much better than to have somebody excited about your work.
You said you took a screenshot of that. Is there a screenshot of that on your wall, like a restaurant posts its first dollar that it's made? I'm hoping that that's on your wall.
No, I'll tell you what is on my, what is framed. It is actually, it's behind me, which you can't see. Obviously, we're on radio. But if you remember, I told my husband, I don't think I'm going to get the gold star. And so I went to write and I did my thing and I went to go home and walk to my car, and on the ground by my driver's side door was a gold metallic star, like one of those gold stars that you'd stick on a calendar or your teacher might have put on your paper years ago.
Right.
It was a little bit bigger than that, and it was on the ground. And so I'm not one to pick things up off the ground, but I did pick up that gold star and it is framed behind me because within a day or two, I got the contract with her. I thought, that is crazy. That is just crazy.
That's fun. That's fun. I have this view that now whenever you see children with gold stars on their paper, you're eyeing them up to maybe take them home and frame them as well. Is that?
Well, they don't mean as much to me as that gold star did, because that gold star, in fact, it may have been the day I got the email from her. It was within days, or it may have happened. I'd have to go back and look at the exact sequence of events, but I just remember thinking, I got my gold star. This is crazy. And yeah, so I framed that. And excellent. I do have my first dollar. I do. Somebody bought a book in cash, and I do have that. So
what attracts you to memoir writing? Because the first book of yours is a memoir. And was that sort of happenstance that the first book was memoir, or because you've got the other 10 or 11 or 12 books, what were they like?
Most of them are memoir. I tend to be a reflective person who finds many things about life interesting. And I've had what are not that uncommon experiences, but experiences that were really, really meaningful to me. So probably the first book-length project I worked on was a memoir about the last year my father was alive. which coincided with me leaving the practice of law, being hospitalized for mental health issues, coming very, very close to ending my life. I mean, just a lot of things kind of coincided. And all he wanted to do when he found out that he had terminal cancer was play golf. And I suddenly had a lot of time on my hands. And so he and I spent that last summer caroming around goat pasture golf courses in Licking County. So that's the book that I really wanted to get out first. But for whatever reason, it just wasn't interesting enough, timely enough. But yeah, I write memoir because that's what interests me. And call me self-centered, call me whatever. But that's what I seem to be best at. And especially taking little snippets of my life and finding meaning in them in a way that when you first look at it, you might not see that there's something else there. And that's what I did. The newsletter that I did for, it was actually 20 years before I found another woman to take it over. All the essays that went in that newsletter, so I had a little essay before the calendar of events. And it was always, this is what's happening and this is what it means. And it happened to be about writing. But it was very much a little tiny snippet of memoir. And that's just what I'm good at. I mean, I've written for Dog Fancy, Dog World. I've written some for some newspapers, did a ton of legal research and writing. But the memoir is just what draws me. I've tried to write novels. I don't know how people come up with plots. Maybe someday I'll figure that out. I have written poetry, so I do have have won some awards for poetry, and so that's sort of another kind of area.
You've also done a lot with mindfulness meditation, and your latest book is Daily Dose of Now, 365 Mindfulness Meditation in the Moment. So tell me about that.
So that project was something that has taken 30 years. I had the idea for it when I was in a recovery meeting in 1993, and the topic was staying in the moment. And as it went around the room, I realized that people didn't really know how to do that. And it was curious to me. And then I remembered that my husband and I had been at a meditation retreat recently, and that's where we learned it. That was a skill that we had learned. And I thought, this is a book that could happen. This is a book where little tiny bits of meditation suggestions could be made, and one for every day. And so I started gathering quotes. These are common books in the recovery community and also in religious communities also, where they have these daily readers where they have a little quote and then they have a little micro essay. And then often it'll be a prayer or an affirmation, but mine has meditation suggestions. They're called daily practices, and they're just tiny little things. Notice your hands on the steering wheel. Notice when you walk through a doorway, which foot goes first, and actually feel your foot go through. So they're mindfulness. My meditation teacher might call them mindful micro hits. And I had been meditating for a long, long time, and I become a certified meditation teacher. And I noticed kind of a gap that there wasn't something like this on the market. And I'd been working on it for all these years. So I decided to bring it into the world last year when it finally felt like it was done. But we talked about me writing memoir, and much of what I write that looks like how-to is actually memoir-ish, because they're little essays about how Nita does this. So if we're meditating on sound, how do I do it? If I'm meditating while I run, how do I do that? And then breaking that down with very specific examples from my life. So even though it looks like a how-to book, it's memoir.
How much of this do you get to share with other people? I'm thinking like outside of meditation classes, because it seems like if you're focusing on, saying, walking through a door or something like that, it might lend itself to make you want to say to other people, hey, have you ever noticed what your hands are like on the steering wheel? Have you ever noticed what it's like to, you know, walk through a doorway? And do you get them into meditation like that?
Yes, yes, that's what it is. Because the whole point of mindfulness practice is to have your mind where your body is. And so you use primarily your senses to do that. Because when you are actually in real time in touch with your senses, whether it's vision, hearing, body sensations like touch, smell, taste, those sensations are in the moment. You're not thinking about the past or the future. You're experiencing what is right here, right now. And so that's the way I do it. And that's the way, it's not just me. I mean, this is 2,000 years old, more than that.
Right.
But that's the mindfulness practice. It's about using what you have, and you can use anything. It's the most adaptable practice there is, to bring your mind where your body is in real time.
What sort of reactions do you get when you talk to folks about that? I mean, it seems like on one hand, it's a very simple practice, something that's easy for anybody to do. But on the other hand, it sort of brings, you know, and I think the idea is it is bringing you, like you said, centering yourself in your body. But I could also see it increasing self-consciousness.
So at first, there is some self-consciousness, and that's necessary in order for you to do the practice, because it's a skill that you're learning that you haven't done. And if you think about anything that you've never done before you can be good at, you're awkward. You don't know what you're mm-hmm. doing, and you have to try it, and you have to develop the muscle that does that thing. So yes, it is a little bit self-conscious. But once you have learned the skill of bringing your mind back into the present moment, it becomes, I wouldn't say it's effortless, but it can become part of your day, just part of your ordinary life, because it is actually very ordinary. It's actually very simple. It's not always easy, but it is simple. So yeah, the reaction I get a couple of reactions. I get, well, that's not really meditation, or that sounds too easy, or I thought I had to go somewhere to do this. I mean, I get a lot of opportunities for myth busting because people have mm-hmm. certain ideas about what meditation is supposed to be. And no, this is not the kind of meditation where, you know, you have to go somewhere to do it. That's my point, is that I'm trying to maybe sneak up on people with meditation, let them know that they can do it anywhere. And then if it becomes something they're interested in, they can find a teacher who does longer retreats or teaches longer classes, things like that, because that's sort of my introduction. My preference is writing. I have taught meditation, I have taught writing, I've taught lots of different things, and I've taught writing as meditation also, because that's a thing I've studied for a long time. But I know that there's a lot of really great teachers who will go really, really deep with you if that's what you want. I'm giving people a taste of it and trying to dispel the idea, oh, I can't meditate. Oh, the other one is my mind wanders too much. Well, yeah, you're alive. Yes. That's your brain's job, is to think thoughts. So I revel in being able to say that what you think it is not really what it is. Try this. Mm-hmm. See what this is.
Yes, the wandering thoughts have always been my problem with meditation, but I like the idea that you've got a brand of sneak up on you meditation so that you may have somewhat less of that, because you're doing it, like you said, with quotidian things in everyday life where you're just watching your hands or feeling your hands on the steering wheel and making that into a form of meditation.
Well, and I think that there's a level of discomfort in thinking that you're supposed to be able to control your thoughts and then not being able to do that, which mm-hmm. actually is pretty much impossible.
The moment that you decide you're going to control your thoughts, you've already lost the battle.
Pretty much, yeah, that's pretty much. And I think that what people don't realize, or what people say to me, they don't realize that what you're doing is you're creating an environment that helps your thoughts slow. It's not about force. It's not about your will. It's about an allowing. And whether that environment is just the intention of noticing which foot goes through the door, or the intention of, okay, I'm going to feel my hand on the steering wheel for the next half a mile or the next 30 seconds. Heck, that's probably good for a lot of people. And some days that's good mm-hmm. for me. That's as good as I can do.
Yeah.
And just that choice sets up an environment where your mind goes, oh, this is interesting. And the other thing is adopting kind of a curiosity about it. So when my mind wanders, where's it going? And then noticing when it's gone, oh, wait, I was going to meditate. I'd selected this time for meditation. Okay. And then gently bringing your mind back, as opposed to saying, oh, man, I just can't do this, and giving up, saying, okay, well, let's just try again. Let's start again and again and again. That mm-hmm. returning, that gentle returning, is possibly the most powerful part of meditation, the remembering and then a gentle returning to whatever you have selected whether it's your foot or your hands or lilacs on the trail or the sound of your feet, whatever you choose, remembering and returning to that thing you have chosen to attend to.
And your book gives 365 different things to return to live in the moment and meditate on. Nita Sweeney, thank you very much for talking to me today. Again, you'll be at the Ohioana Book Festival, and information about that will be on craftheshow.com. Nita Sweeney, thank you.
Thank you.
For more information from my guests, visit www.craftheshow.com. This is Doug Dangler. Until next time, be creative.
I know when you hear podcasts, you may think, I'm not great with technology. I don't want to have one more thing to worry about. But I'm here to tell you, you're missing out on so many amazing stories. And WCBE has made it easier than ever to listen to their own curated list of locally produced podcasts. Just go to WCBE.org and click the podcast experience. You don't have to learn how to use any new technology. Just click on the podcast you want to hear and click play. And don't forget to listen to my show, The Internet Says It's True with Michael Kent.